This is the last of our meetings together for this Sunday series, the 1971-72 year. And by rights, I ought to have chosen as my topic this morning some sunshine subject. Some subject filled with the sunlight and the hope of the springtime. There's a wise tradition among our people, an old tradition, which insists that after a period of self-examination or of critical analysis of study, one always ought to end with what our fathers called divrei tanchumim, words of encouragement, a gut wort. A good, happy, encouraging word. The long history of our people convinces us that there is more to life than crisis and the darkness. Weeping may tarry for the night, but with the morning there is joy. And we know psychologically that there is no mood more debilitating than one of bleak, black despair. Our people have often lived in straitened circumstances. Has often been reasoned to be grim in analysis of the situation in which they lived. And yet they tried to end each year, each period, with a statement of hope. And yet I find that I cannot leave off this year without dealing with that crisis, Vietnam, which must be a central concern for us. And I confess that I find very little that is either encouraging or hopeful in the way that the Vietnamese situation seems to be developing, the policies which have been developed by all sides. You and I have tended to believe, because our government has encouraged us to believe, the Vietnamese war was winding down, at least for the United States. We were on our way towards disengagement, getting out, and that we were achieving this without any marked diminution, weakening of the South Vietnamese position, without any attack on the integrity of the South Vietnamese territory. Again and again, the last 18 months and the last 24 months, our administration has insisted that all seems to be going well. There was a timetable, and the president made a great deal about meeting each and every mark along that way. One of the fascinating things to me about the Vietnamese war, the so-called technological war, has been our fascination with numbers during it. The first set of numbers had to do with kill ratios, how many of the other were dying for how few of ours. And when we moved beyond the kill ratio, we came to the pacification numbers. Every week or so, the government would announce how many more hamlets, how many more district and provincial capitals were now deemed to be wholly within the purview, the control of our side. We moved from these numbers in the last 3 years to a new set of numbers, the numbers of troops whom we had withdrawn from Vietnam. 3 years ago, there were 565,000 troops in Vietnam, our troops, and then the number fell to 280,000 and 220,000 and 160,000. Today, on the land of Vietnam, of South Vietnam, there are apparently some 68,000 Americans. And these numbers again mesmerized us. We find some kind of salvation, we technocrats in numbers. And we came to believe that because the numbers was dropping, we were on our way towards active disengagement. And if we had not arrived at any kind of negotiated settlement, if Paris was leading nowheres, well, what difference did it make? America would be out, the problem would rest where the problem properly belongs, on the South Vietnamese shoulders themselves, with the South Vietnamese government. The United States could call it quits and we could go and attend to some more urgent business at home. 3 years ago, two and a half years ago, our administration unveiled a new panacea to all of our problems in Vietnam. It was called Vietnamization. It meant essentially, as I understood it, that we would provide arms and equipment and technical know-how and advisors to the South Vietnamese Army. But they would do the land fighting. We would provide some kind of air umbrella to these soldiers until they could take over the air war themselves. We would provide the substance, they would provide the bodies. They would promise that the Vietnamese feudal economy and feudal military structure and corruption would be dealt with appropriately. Vietnam would become that very, very model Western state that three, four American presidents have insisted that it was from the very beginning, and that we know it has never been. We were told that all was going well with the timetable of U.S. withdrawal and with the timetable of Vietnamization, and Americans by and large accepted this profession, these statements from Washington, even the most skeptical. Even the most radical of our student groups. Time and again in the last year or so, I've picked up some of these newspapers and I've read articles on the general theme, what should be our agenda now that Vietnam is over? Oh, there was carping about the slowness of the final act of withdrawal. But it was assumed that everything was in motion and it was just a question of time. And no one released to the American people the report that Dr. Kissinger had given to President Nixon 3 years ago, the very beginning of his administration, a report which had examined the possibilities of Vietnamization of this policy and which had concluded that it would require a dozen years or more or the full effect of military and social and political reconstruction, renewal of Vietnam to take place. None of the American people were told that Vietnamization was not so much a reality as a possibility, a long-term possibility, and that for it to succeed, there had to be a long-term investment of American support and a great deal of hope. But it was not today's reality. And so we moved ahead happily, confidently, thinking of other things. The festering wound was still with us. General Giap, the leaders of Hanoi, may or may not have known of the Kissinger report. But certainly they had their own sources of information, honeycomb throughout of South Vietnam, and they knew what the American people did not know. That Vietnamization was a public relations puff, that it had no real relationship to the reality in the field. North Vietnam went ahead with its preparations to take advantage of American confidence, American hypocrisy to its own people, of South Vietnamese weakness, because North Vietnam has never had any desire to allow President Nixon that which he most devoutly hopes for, that he could withdraw American troops and at the same time achieve at the negotiating table what the American military presence had not been able to achieve from the very beginning. Why were we in South Vietnam, according to our own self-definition? In order to create there something which had not been there before, a state called South Vietnam, in order to thwart the decision of the Geneva Conference of 1954, which spoke of a single Vietnam, or at least of the necessity of there being elections, a plebiscite, to see about the possibilities of reunification. Secretary Dulles, after 1954, I decided that South Vietnam should not be part of the communist apparatus. And so we had gone there to create a state. And everything we have done there has attempted to create the demilitarized zone as a geographic accepted political barrier, a boundary. Nixon seemed to have been moving ahead on the assumption that we could withdraw our troops. Because there was a lull on the battlefield and because South Vietnam seemed to be in control of all land south of the demilitarized zone and all land that was east of Cambodia and Laos to the sea, that we would be able to achieve there the kind of success that we had not been able to achieve on the battlefield. This the North Vietnamese have never been prepared to allow. And so, 8 weeks ago, the North Vietnamese unleashed a major military offensive which struck south along the coastal highways, south of the militarized zone towards Quang Tri and towards Hue, which struck southeast from Laos and Cambodia into the central highlands, which struck in southeastern Cambodia at the fire bases which control the entrance to the long valley of Cambodia known as the Parrot's Beak, which is like a dagger pointed directly at Saigon. And they began to move forward with massive military interposition. And they had, as we well know, a number of signal successes. And in very short order, on the battlefield, the North Vietnamese proved what had always been a fact, that Vietnamization had been a word and not a reality, that the corruption and the politicization of the provincial governments and of the army of South Vietnam had not been eradicated. The South Vietnamese army was not an effective fighting force, that the South Vietnamese government did not, in effect, control the land, the heartland of the supposed country. Quang Tri, the northern province, provincial capital, fell, apparently without a very serious fight. The division of South Vietnamese, which was charged with the defense of Quang Tri, disintegrated. Its officers were the first to run off by jeep and by helicopter to the safety of Saigon, and the men deserted of their leadership turned to looting and to rape. Yesterday on the papers, we saw, in television, we saw the pictures of those who are to defend Hue, the next great capital. 1,200 South Vietnamese Marines, regulars, and a few thousand militia, the wounded, 70-year-old white-bearded veterans. The troops that came in from the east moved easily through most of the lands of the central highlands. Dak To, Con Tum fell, Pleiku was besieged. Two divisions of regulars and of militia disintegrated. They put their women, their children, their baggage, their loot on the helicopters which were supposedly carrying military supplies. They left their men, and the men disappeared, probably to reappear in North Vietnamese uniforms. The fire bases that were to defend this Paris Beach area were overrun. The city of An Lộc, which is a provincial capital on the main road which runs from the northwest to Saigon, and which is as close to Saigon as Akron is to Cleveland, was defended by an elite corps and is held. But the city is razed. I was reminded as I read of this defense of the comment which was overheard by an American correspondent, Peter Arnett, during the Tet Offensive when he visited one of these provincial capitals which was defended at that time in the Mekong Valley. And the American major who was in charge of the defense said, well, we had to destroy the city in order to save it. An Lộc may be saved, but it's destroyed. And this offense now seems to be gathering momentum for a second major push. And certain things are already clear. The first, that for the 110th time during this long debacle, which is called American involvement in Vietnam, our information, our intelligence has been faulty. Secondly, that we have continued to assume that the North Vietnamese have the same set of objectives this time as they had last time, where in fact this new invasion is totally different than all that has existed before. We are mesmerized by Tet. Remember the Tet invasion and offensive of 1968? These lightning series of attacks on a number of provincial centers. Hue fell for some 30 days. The American army was bloodied and the South Vietnamese army was bloodied, and a president of the United States found he could no longer run for re-election. Well, during that offensive, the apparent strategy of the North Vietnamese was not to move as traditional armies have moved from land bases and bases of supply, gobbling up territory which you then plan to hold, but to move ahead in a series of lightning strikes which would bring terror and hopefully demoralization to the enemy, and then there would be what they call in communist propaganda a general insurrection. That is, the native population will rise up and support the invaders, and you will have achieved what you have not achieved in the battlefield. That is, the native population will take over control of the cities and they will become yours. That was the gamble of 1968 for the North Vietnamese, and they were mistaken. When they came to Hue and took over the heart of the city, the people of Hue did not, for the most part, rise up to join the North Vietnamese. And you remember that there was a massacre at Hue of many of the citizens, over 3,000, because they would not participate or support the North Vietnamese conquerors once they had moved into the city. Well, this time, the North Vietnamese army seems not to be counting on a general insurrection. This is an old-fashioned European-type military campaign to conquer land. They are moving from their own bases deliberately across territory, which they will control. And there's no intention, apparently, of giving up this territory if they must fall back, because they are obviously now superior on the land to the South Vietnamese forces which oppose them. And the purpose of this invasion seems to break down to be the determination to destroy once and for all the illusion that there is something called South Vietnam. There is an army in South Vietnam. That's a reality. There's a junta that governs from Saigon. That is a reality. But it is not a reality that the DMZ or the so-called Cambodian border is essentially an immutable border, inviolate. President Nixon will not be able to send anyone back to Paris or to secret negotiations any place in the world any longer on the assumption that whatever negotiated settlement he can achieve will assume what he would like to call the territorial integrity of South Vietnam. It doesn't exist any longer. How much of South Vietnam will remain in the hands of the South Vietnamese government is problematic. Where they will be able to draw defensive perimeters and hold them for a period of time. But what apparently is developing there is now that a series of attacks by the North Vietnamese, which will gobble up large amounts of territory, which will push the South Vietnamese south and towards the sea. We may have a series of small Dunkirks as Hue or Da Nang or the other coastal cities have to be evacuated. The Mekong will soon be invaded and remilitarized, the rice bowl of the Saigon government. We'll probably find that after a period of stabilization, there'll be an iron ring around Saigon, which will be fed by an American airlift, fed by sea at great cost if it's maintained, and some kind of new attempt by the President of the United States to reestablish by negotiations, which he must now do from weakness, establish the territorial integrity of the non-state for whose survival we have fought now for 10 years. Now, the President of the United States has reacted with frustration, with bitterness, with all the kinds of contradictory emotions which one associates from one's own private experience with frustration, bitterness. It's understandable. It's not pretty to see. He blames one day the Russians for having supplied the troops and the equipment which make possible this invasion. The next day he sends Dr. Kissinger to Moscow to try and use Russian good offices to adjust some kind of settlement. He sends our ambassadors to Paris. He pulls them out of Paris. He sends them back to Paris. He announces that we will continue, despite everything, the withdrawal of our troops in the same week. He sends our planes north to bomb Haiphong and Hanoi. There seems to be no clear principle of direction emanating from Washington, but a great deal of frustration. Because the President of the United States is hoisted now on his own petard. He has understood, or he said he understood, that America had been defeated in Southeast Asia, that we could not impose a military solution that suited our needs on that part of the world. And at the same time, he's insisted that he will politically achieve the very thing that we could not achieve militarily. He's held out hope to the American people of a solution which is apparently not going to be, unless he is going to try, against the will of the majority of the American people, to re-involve us in the war, to re-escalate our commitment, which may now be a very, very difficult thing to do. Normally, I have great sympathy for the President of the United States. He has a terrible, frightful responsibility. He is under terrible pressures. Lives depend on his decisions. But I confess, in this instant, most of my usual sympathy is simply not there. Because the President of the United States must understand the fatal logic of our position in Vietnam. It's been clear for so many years. Let me try something with you this morning. Never done this before. And let me let you listen to a voice talking to you about Vietnam, talking to you, the voice you'll find familiar, not in 1972, but 10 years ago, from this very pulpit. At a time when our involvement in Vietnam involved less technicians than we now have soldiers after these massive withdrawals. When we had lost in Vietnam, all told, less men than are killed by homicide in a year in Cuyahoga County. And if the logic, the fatal logic of Vietnam, was clear 10 years ago to a rabbi who had absolutely no special information, who couldn't send his Dulleses and his Rusks and his Rogers and his Kissingers and his Gavins and his Westmorelands, etc., etc., to gain fuller knowledge on the field. Well, let's listen.
What then is the war in South Vietnam? It cannot be explained as a war for freedom, a war for democracy. Surely the actions of Ngo Diem and of the Dragon Lady, Madame Nguyen, make any such claim laughable. Can it be claimed to be a war for free enterprise, for the capitalistic system? Southeast Asia has never known free enterprise. It is a feudal economy, and it threatens to remain largely a feudal economy. What then is it? I suspect that the war in Southeast Asia is largely a war over spheres of influence. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese have, over the past several centuries, infiltrated into this area. Many have waxed economically wealthy and have established important connections between this rich rice land and their homeland. At the same time, Southeast Asia was a colonial dominion of Europe, most lately of France, and her wealth was exploited to the advantage of the Europeans. Why is the United States involved in Southeast Asia? I'm afraid that the government of the United States has never made a precise and clear explanation of this fact to the American people. I frankly myself am confused. I suspect that we are in Southeast Asia because of a geography lesson that Secretary of State John Foster Dulles gave to all of us about 10 years ago. He drew out for us the world, and he had painted in red all the nations of the world which were communist, and he drew a line around all these communist nations, and he said, thus far shall they go and no further. All that is outside this line is ours. And we set up to defend all that was outside of this line. And we became, in these strange parts of the world, in these exotic parts of the world, we found ourselves in a strange, unbelievable position. We had to decide in Laos which of three blooded, hereditary feudal noblemen was communist and which was anti-communist. They were all brothers. They were all simply struggling for the throne. We had to decide in South Vietnam how long we could tolerate a most malodorous dictatorship. When did its religious oppression, its feudal venality, become so overbearing that we had to help stimulate a revolution to overthrow it? Long ago, General of the Army Douglas MacArthur warned the American people that a military action in Southeast Asia could not be won. It would seem, in fact, that it cannot be won. Indeed, what we are fighting for is some sphere of influence in this rich part of the world, then is not the answer the neutralization of these nations, an answer which we have already accepted for Laos? It was just this last week we said we were prepared to accept for the neighboring state of Cambodia. Why cannot we devolve some major multinational guarantee of the political neutrality of these unbelievably medieval and feudal states and let them go their own way and work out their own destiny and cease trying to fit their complications and their orientalisms into the black and white colors of a Cold War with which they have absolutely no relationship? Indeed, I would have been made far more happier. The President of the United States had promised several months ago not that we would win the war in South Vietnam by election time next year and have our troops home, but had he promised a major reevaluation of the aims and objectives of that war, because I do not believe that any president can make good on the pledge to win the military action.
Now, the lesson is not that the President of the United States ought to go to shul, although that wouldn't hurt his soul. The lesson is that from the very beginning, the war in Vietnam has been illogical, irresponsible, justifiable only by a kind of imperial greed, a kind of globalism, which has infected American politics for the last 15 years. We have somehow mesmerized ourselves about the importance of South Vietnam, so that now American prestige, American economic vitality, indeed the survival of many other nations in the free world seem to depend on what happens in Southeast Asia. Just a week ago, the President of the United States went down to a steer roast of plutocrats in Texas, and he told the assembled oligarchy that we had to be successful in our negotiations and in our aims in Southeast Asia and South Vietnam, because if we went back on our word to the South Vietnamese people, the presidency of the United States could no longer be respected. And as I listened, and rather as I read these words, I thought to myself of the presidency of France. General de Gaulle had accepted defeat, the bad news of Algeria, and pulled out the troops, and France had been the stronger, and he had been the stronger for the action. No, the respect which we give to the presidency of the United States and which the world will be given if he has the courage to accept what is clearly written, it has been written for years, that whatever aims we may have had, these aims have been frustrated. Whatever purposes we have had, these purposes have been defeated. And that the only solution in Southeast Asia is to say, by July 1, by September 1, 1972, we are out. Lock, stock, and B-52s. Otherwise, we court disaster. We court another Cuban missile crisis, the peace of the world. We begin to blockade Haiphong Harbor to keep Russian, Chinese equipment out of North Vietnam. There is a limit to how far these two great communist powers will sit idly by and allow us to blast away. There is a limit to the effectiveness of our blasting away. More bombs have been dropped by American bombers on North and South Vietnam in the last years than were dropped by the planes of all wars in history. It requires apparently 2.5 tons of bombs to kill one man. We're again going to go into the fatal fallacy of 66, 67, 68, that somehow if we increase the level of our aerial support, of our aerial bombing, we're going to win for our side. And it's not only the peace of the world which is at stake, because obviously China and Russia could withhold some kind of response if they wish, but our own domestic peace. The longer the President of the United States stays in Southeast Asia, the more difficult it will be for him to extend American aid and support to any nation in the free world. The mood of isolationism, which is beginning to grip these United States, has risen in direct proportion to the frustration of the American people over South Vietnam. We live in a period, you and I, where the Soviet Union and China are expansionist, where there are many states which have legitimate claims on certain kinds of specific Western support. If we allow, if the President allows, the American involvement in Southeast Asia to roil the conscience, to sap at the vitals of the American people for much longer, I'm afraid that he and his successor will find that it is almost impossible to maintain the flow of aid and supplies and economic advantage which we have given to those who still are part of the so-called free world, those who have a legitimate claim on our support. And if we don't want to see our allies in Western Europe and Asia and Africa reduced to impotence, then I suspect we have to disengage ourselves quickly in order to make it clear that policy is a very complex and difficult undertaking, and that the simplicity of isolationism is as false and as suicidal for America as the simplicity of globalism, which got us into Southeast Asia. I began by saying I searched for a line of hope with which to end this series. And I began by saying that I find it difficult to describe to you a line of hope. I suspect that the only hope which really exists now is that the mood of the American people precludes many actions which a government might take if the American people were more belligerent, less blooded, more willing to recommit themselves to Southeast Asia. But we must never denigrate, minimize the capacity of the public relation arms of our government to encourage the feelings that America is the invincible, America cannot be defeated, our honor is at stake. We must do something to protect the poor Vietnamese who will be slaughtered if we pull out. Believe me, more Vietnamese, more poor Vietnamese are being slaughtered every week during this offensive than would be slaughtered if North Vietnam were to take over all of South Vietnam now. And we have no illusions that many of the South Vietnam want North Vietnamese overlordship. Nor have I any illusions that the first to climb aboard American transport planes would be Diem and Key and those others who have made millions off of this war. I pray that the President of the United States will choke back his frustration and listen to the cry of the American people and accept what must be a terribly unpalatable medicine, come before the American people and say simply, "My fellow Americans, we have been defeated in South Vietnam. Someday historians may reevaluate the purposes which brought us there. Madiavaravad, what is done. The task for Americans now is to reassess our domestic and international priorities and to recommit ourselves to these. But for us, South Vietnam is a closed chapter. All of us bear some guilt for the death and the destruction. Those of us in government bear more guilt than most. But there is no advantage in displaying our guilt and our penitence in public. Let's be on with the business at hand." And I suspect that the American people more or less accept this kind of statement from the President of the United States, and he would gain again in our estimation had he the courage to make it. That if he wants respect from the American people, this is really the only path which now lies open to him. The complex, artificial deck of political cards which he had raised before us, in which he was, as a Svengali, going to achieve as we withdraw what we could not achieve when we were there. This deck of cards is scattered to the winds. It has fallen before this latest North Vietnamese offensive. It can never be rebuilt. About all that can happen, I'm afraid, in the near future, and Vietnam is that we build more and more graves and gravestones. The military cemeteries and the civilian cemeteries are expanded even more than they have been in that tragic land. America is strong and America has many possibilities. But until we disengage ourselves from Vietnam, all these, in a sense, remain in abeyance. For Vietnam is a cancer, eating at the American body politic, spreading every day. It's a level of frustration, it's the economic cost. It's more and more clearly seen. What we need is surgery, radical surgery. What we need is the kind of leadership capable of carrying out that surgery. May it be so. Amen.